So this is Monday, November 28th, is that correct? It's about in class, and I'm sure you'll hear lots of scratching and rattling around as I do this. Okay, so there we go. So we're starting on overhead number two. So you have the colipase right here. You got the colipase. You got the lipase right here. Now, what's the problem with the lipase is that, of course, it has to sit at this juncture at this interface of oil and water, and it's acting on this oil droplet and producing lots of fatty acids and glycerol. Fatty acids and glycerol, but as you know, most enzymes are folded, most proteins are folded such that the nonpolar materials are buried toward the interior. And here this thing is sitting right at that interface where that oil droplet is nonpolar. So there is a tremendous tendency, there is a driving force that would help, that would try to or help unfold that lipase. So a second protein, not that has no enzyme activity at all, but a second protein comes in, sits next to the lipase called colipase, and the colipase is designed to stabilize the lipase so that it doesn't unfold in the presence of the oil droplet. So the colipase and lipase have to exist together. Notice they're in a one-to-one ratio with lipase. Other lipases include phospholipase A2, which is a major component. Other phospholipase is a minor component. Of course, if you're eating anything that was alive at one time, it's going to have a cell membrane. And therefore, there are lots of phospholipids that the body has to prepare for by digesting. At any rate, so you produce fatty acids. You produce 2-monoacylglycerols. What do you think that 2-monoacylglycerol is? What do you think that is? It's actually a chemical classification. 2-monoacylglycerol. What do you think the backbone is? What's the fundamental structure? Glycerol. Monoacyl means it has how many fatty acids attached to it? And the 2 means it's at position what? 2. So it's got the middle position occupied with a fatty acid as an ester bond. Then you have this micelle, which we'll talk about more later. That crosses through the lipid membrane, apparently without assistance. And then if you have long-chain fatty acids, they're reformed as triacylglycerols, literally fat molecules. They're repackaged along with proteins and phospholipids into a material called chylomicron. This is a lipoprotein, chylomicron. It exclusively carries fats from digestion. So the chylomicron only comes from the intestinal tract. And it gets carried into the lymph system, not the blood system, but the lymph system. Whereas medium chain and short chain fatty acids are absorbed directly, transported through, and move into the capillary, into the blood system. So the chylomicrons end in the capillary system, in the lymph system, where the fatty acids, the short chain and medium chain, end up in the blood system. How does that occur? Do we know more detail about that? Yes, we do. Let's check it out. Once inside the intestinal cell, the fate of the fatty acid chains depends on their side, as I mentioned earlier here, just in the previous diagram. The first blank is called medium. Second blank is FABP. The next blank is A, lipoproteins. Next blank is chylomicrons. Next blank is micelles. Next blank is aqueous. Next blank and final blank is thoracic duct. Thoracic duct. All right, so again, here are the fates. Here, previous diagram, that's what I have previous here. Medium length, they're simply transported through and dumped into the capillary system. Previous, again, long chain fatty acids become bound to this intestinal fatty acid binding protein, which is in the interior of the cell. It transports that fatty acid to the ER. There it's reformed as triglycerides and packaged into apolipoproteins. The specific one is called chylomicron. It's transported to the lymph system where eventually dumped in large body veins via the thoracic duct. up in here. It's eventually pumped through the lymph system into a duct that's near lots of agitation that occurs near your heart, a lot of blood flow. What are the pumps for the lymph system? What are the pumps? I'm sorry, what? Skeletal muscles. Yeah, primarily your left leg and your right leg and your left arm and your right arm. Who knew that who knew that Father Abraham was in fact a ode to the lymph system? Does that make any sense? That stupid joke I just said? Okay, good. Thank you very much. Previous and below, formation of mixed micelles. These mixed micelles, now what is a micelle? A micelle, of course, is a package of fat surrounded by molecules that allow it to be soluble in water. Allow the hydrolyzed lipid to cross the unstirred aqueous boundary layer at the intestinal wall. What are you talking about? Unstirred aqueous boundary layer at the intestinal wall. Well, here you got these capillaries. I mean, you got these villi. And the villi have villi. And the villi, oddly enough, are water-loving. And there ends up having a layer of water that is kind of adheres to these microvilli. This layer of water just kind of goes along for the ride. As these intestinal walls are agitated by the smooth muscles and so on, you end up having this very thin microscopic layer of water right at the interface between the microvilli and the chyme that is adhered primarily to the microvilli and not really stirred, not really agitated. It's almost like there's a pool of quiet water, a thin layer of water around the villi that is not particularly agitated. The bulk water is, but not this thin layer. Well, that presents a problem for transportation of fats. It almost acts as a polar barrier to fatty acids and fats moving across that. So the body has solved that by making the fat very water soluble, by packaging the fat in these mixed micelles. And so the presence of these mixed micelles and their high water solubility allows the fats and the micelle, the fats in the micelle, to cross this unstirred aqueous boundary layer and move into and be absorbed by the microcapillaries and the capillaries, the microvilli and villi of the intestinal tract. How do you know this? Well, this comes from experimental data and also from patient data. Individuals who have poor gallbladder operation or poor production of bile salts that help make these mixed micelles have a terrible time digesting fats. The fats end up staying undigested in the intestinal tract, and they either cause bacterial overgrowth or overproduction of carbon dioxide, or they stay unmetabolized at all, and you end up having this oily diarrhea that comes from a lack of digestion or absorption of the fat. So these mixed micelles are very important for moving the fatty acids and fats across this unstirred aqueous boundary layer. And the chylomicron is eventually dumped into the lymph system. Here you can see this. Here's the gastric lipase, which means it's lipase that it was dumped into the stomach. Triglycerides make fatty acids and diglycerides and monoglycerides. You have these packages of emulsion droplets. Then bile salts comes in from the pancreatic lipase. Bile salts and pancreatic lipase and colipase are dumped in the duodenum. They make these mixed micelles that then cross that aqueous boundary layer. All right. Whoops, that's not helpful. All right, so Once you now have the fat and fatty acids in your lymph system and blood system, what happens? Well, the fat that comes from outside the body is packaged into lipoproteins called chylomicrons. Eventually, they move into the capillaries of peripheral tissue, and there in these capillaries, they meet an enzyme that's literally sticking out into the blood flow. Okay, it's just sticking out there. It's attached to the epithelial cells lining the capillaries. And it's called lipoprotein lipase on the inner surface of the capillary. These run into these chylomicrons and actually act on the fat in the chylomicron and release fatty acids into the intercellular or interstitial fluid next to the muscles and adipose tissues, where the fatty acids are absorbed by the muscle and adipose tissue. Given the primary fuel for major muscle groups, if there isn't carbohydrate, of course, it's fat. And so that's why you have, when you eat meat, you invariably find fat interculcated throughout the structure of the meat, meat tissue, muscle tissue, because they place the fat where the energy needs are. Anyway, so the chylomicron remnants, and there are remnants because there's a protein tag that's a part of the chylomicron. It's absorbed by the liver, and then that cholesterol, the remnants, is recycled into bile salts, other lipids, other density lipids, they degraded, for example. Then we talk about these VLDLs, IDLs, LDLs, and HDLs. These are endogenous lipids. Does anybody recall what, like, HDL stands for? Okay, what's VLDL stand for? Now, what dictates its density? What dictates its density? We'll discover that in a little bit. I'm sorry, what? Oh, okay. VLDLs are produced by the liver. Also, many of these are produced by tissues other than the intestinal tract. So the VLDLs are produced by the liver if there's lots of fat. They're transported to peripheral tissues, having the same fate as exogenous lipids. In other words, that the liver has absorbed all this carbohydrate. It gets made up into glycogen. If there's still energy available, it makes it into fat. The fat that gets packaged into the VLDLs and dumped in the blood to be delivered to the adipose tissue to be stored there, because you don't want to store your fat in your liver. It happens sometimes, and fatty liver is a very serious disease that people can get. It hampers the function of the liver significantly in ways that are surprising. All right, any rate, now then, once you produce these VLDLs and they begin to be hydrolyzed or acted upon by various tissues, you find that they change their density. So VLDLs create these intermediate density lipoproteins, which through the action of LPL, which is this thing up here, even though it's typoed a little different, produces these LDLs. The LDLs are absorbed by extrahepatic tissues. Macrophages are shown. HDLs, interestingly enough, are synthesized in the intestine and the liver. Not only extrahepatic tissue shown. So when you look at the next thing, the next overhead, you're going to see that HDLs are produced by tissues other than the liver, although the liver can't produce them. Here is a package. Here is a just a model of what these lipoprotein lipases, lipoproteins look like. You basically have an inner layer, inner droplet of fats and cholesterol that's surrounded by a single layer of phospholipids. The lipid portion points toward the fatty interior. The phospho group, phospholipid, is in on the surface that you see right here and points out toward the water. You sometimes find cholesterol in there as well, but there's cholesterol and fatty acids here. It's wrapped, apparently, or somehow integrated with a protein. It's called apolipoprotein, is the protein tag that goes on there. That protein tag is sort of like a FedEx symbol on a package that you scan it and it tells it where you're headed for. And you can track it. It's kind of like the UPC symbol, universal product code on a can of green beans or whatever. Again, it's a tag that tells the body where it's from and where it's going to. Although it's not as accurate as you might suspect. I mean, it's not as specific as you might suspect. These things have a tendency to kind of wander all over. They specialize in certain tissues, but aren't targeted necessarily for special tissues, for specific tissues. Let's take a look at what makes lipoproteins have different density. Let's take a look at the targeting. I need for you to be able to draw this in three dimensions in the proper color. So on Wednesday when you come, I need for you to bring some color pencils. Okay. And, no? You don't think so? I didn't see a lot of unhappy reactions, so I presume you figured I was kidding. Which I am. Let's take a look at what's going on here. Let's take a look. All right, so here's the intestinal tract, and we're going to go through a variety of things here. We'll just do this very quickly because I'm not going to ask you any questions about it. It just gives you a mental image of what's going on in the digestion. So here's the dietary fat. On Friday, that was what? What was that dietary fat that was coming down your esophagus? You guys remember what happened on Friday? Was it Friday I did that? Friday. With the little Oreo cookies? Right? Oh, was that Tuesday of last week?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Let me be more general and more accurate. The last time we met, we did the Oreo cookie thing. And so you had that chocolate and fat go down your esophagus, land in your intestinal tract, and begin to be emulsified, where you created these large lipid drops, where eventually due to the fact of the pancreatic juices and so on, notice you have bile acids, gallbladder, where it's stored, and the fat hits the stomach and sends out a signal, hey, I got fat here, that causes the smooth muscles around the gallbladder to squeeze, and they pump this bile acids and lipases into the duodenum, where those large droplets are broken down into small droplets or micelles. So the micelles are packaged into these things. The lipases begin to act on the triacylglycerols. Do you like that forked, where they become into these fatty acids? The fatty acids cross into the small intestinal lining, into the epithelial cells, where they're repackaged as chylomicrons and get dumped in the lymph system. The lymph system then gets pumped where it's dumped in the blood vessel, and the cholesterol-rich chylomicron remnants end up going up to the liver, or, notice here, they're broken apart. They're emptied. How do they get that? What enzyme breaks apart the fats in the chylomicron? What was the name of that enzyme? Lipoprotein lipase, and where is it located? Yeah, in the capillaries, in the surface of the capillary. And so that produces smaller chylomicrons and fatty acids. Fatty acids then are taken to the adipose tissue or the muscle tissue where they're stored. The cholesterol-rich chylomicron remnants end up going to the liver, where they make VLDLs, and then that gets transported out again into the adipose tissue, make IDLs, LDLs, cycled through the liver. And you see here in the extrahepatic tissues, you make these HDLs. What do the HDLs stand for? Correct. All right. So now that you see this diagram, it looks confusing, doesn't it? Well, if you want to enter into a nightmare, go do lipoprotein research in a graduate school. This is horribly, terribly simplified. There's literally dozens of different types of lipoproteins floating around in your bloodstream at any given instant. All of them moving between different tissues at different rates and carrying different things. So this is terribly simplified. Like I said, if you want to go get into a nightmare, work on this in your graduate studies. I hope somebody does, but nevertheless, be prepared. It will be something of a challenge to keep it all straight. Now then, you see right here we have chylomicrons, VLDLs, IDLs, LDLs, and HDLs. Notice chylomicrons. Notice what their density is. Is that more dense or less dense than water? What's the density of water in grams per cubic centimeter? What is it? One. They're chylomicrons. Therefore, they're what? Less dense. Truly obese people, if you would, after I was reading about a guy in England who became at one time the world's heaviest man. And during the height of his weight, he was eating 20,000 calories a day. Goodness. Yeah, he weighed like 60 stone. Or he weighed 70 stone. How does that translate into the pound? How does it translate into the pound? Anybody know how many pounds are in a stone? Anybody here from the British system? Anybody here from Canada? 14? Are you sure 14? 14 pounds in a stone? Oh, good grief. Why did I think it was something different than that? One stone equals 14 pounds. Really? Okay. I thought it was 32 pounds in a stone. Huh. I wonder why I thought that. Well, at any rate, there are 14 pounds in a stone. I'm glad you corrected me on that. 14 pounds in a stone. So, if you weighed 70 stone... Yeah. Wow. That's a lot of weight. Yeah. And so, of course, he was on the British medical system, and they took care of him. And now he's lost a bunch of weight. He's now asking them to remove all the excess skin. Excess skin. Okay, so chylomicrons. So would this float on... The reason I'm going through that, if you take the blood out of a person who's had a recent high-fat meal or someone who's grossly overweight, and you just let it sit, there will be a layer of fat that rises to the surface on the blood sample. Yum. Okay. And when you die, if you're grossly overweight, and you die horizontally, all that fat eventually rises to the surface in the blood before it congeals. And so along the top or wherever you died, however you died, if you died in your side, then on this side, when you cut into a blood vessel, that's where all the fat is that was in your blood. Primarily because fat is less dense than water. So here you have a chylomicron that's got density of less than one. You've got VLDLs, very low density, which is even more dense than chylomicrons, but not as dense as HDLs. I want you to relate the following, however. Please notice the relationship between density, percent of weight by protein, and triacylglycerols percentage. Chylomicrons are by weight between 1.5% and 2.5% protein. They are 84 to 90% fat, which is why they are less dense than water. Going to the other extreme, we see HDLs, which percentage of protein by weight is 40 to 55% of their weight is protein, whereas only 3 to 5% of their weight is triacylglycerols. HDLs are fat scavengers. They are produced by extrahepatic tissue and literally scout the blood, picking up extraneous fat molecules. This is why when your doctor does a cholesterol ratio test, they're checking, VLDLs or VLDLs or IDLs. Maybe it's LDL versus HDL. At any rate, they're checking one of the lower density lipoproteins versus HDL. HDL is called the good, whereas all the others, LDL, IDL, VLDL, are called the bad. Okay? Which I really hate. As a chemist, I hate. Because cholesterol is the same molecule. Well, how can it be good at one time and bad at the other? But this is the attempt to help the general public understand what in the world is going on in their own body. So HDLs have a very high percentage of the lipoprotein tag. About half of the percent, over half of the weight is that, and very low level of fat, and therefore do that scavenging business. Notice the tags that you find here. Major apolipoproteins, all of these individual proteins that you see here can be tagged in any of the HDLs or VLDLs. For example, you've got a C1 that can tag an HDL, you have a C1 that can tag a VLDL. So, like I said, it becomes a nightmare to figure out what's going on and how one moves. Trends in actual density match the name. Percent composition of the protein is related to its density. Recall the origins and physiological role of each of the plasma membrane, plasma lipoproteins. What I'm primarily interested in is chylomicrons and HDLs in terms of their source and their purpose and why they have the density they have. Chylomicrons and HDLs, their source, their purpose, and why they have the density they have. Oh, again, do this next same thing. What happens to the LDLs that get recycled by the fat? Well, the LDLs come in here and get captured by the clathrin-coated pits. They then get formed in this clathrin-coated vesicle that bonds with an endosome that changes its pH. When it changes its pH, the receptor disengages from the lipoprotein and gets recycled. The clathrin triskelions, which you mentioned before, recycle and form more coated pits. The endosome gets acted upon by the lysosome to make a secondary lysosome, and you get fatty acids and amino acids. The cholesterol then is moved into the endoplasmic reticulum where it's attempted to be made into LDLs. Well, depending on how much cholesterol is coming from the surface, you can either have the synthetase decrease or increase, or you can have the LDL receptor synthesis decrease or increase. The more cholesterol you have on the surface coming in, the more likely that the HGM-CoA reductase, which is a part of cholesterol biosynthesis, and the LDL receptor is going to be turned off the more you have coming in from the outside of the cell. Long-term feedback control by the amount of enzyme in the cell. LDL endocytosis influences the amount of cholesterol in the cell. And then the HDL is responsible for the turn of the cholesterol to the liver. Surplus cholesterol is disposed of as released by bile acids. Cholesterol is not metabolized by carbon dioxide and water by any mechanism in humans. So the only way you can get rid of cholesterol once it's formed is to excrete it in your intestinal tract. You poop it out. Once it's made, it's pooped out as bile salts. Not all of it. Many of the bile salts are recycled, but there's a significant amount of cholesterol that's lost through your intestinal tract. If you ate no cholesterol, would you make cholesterol? Do you make cholesterol naturally? About 600, 800 milligrams a day. Can you have a no cholesterol diet and still have heart disease? Yeah, because much of heart disease is genetically based. A guy named Jim Fix, ever hear of Jim Fix? He was, in the 1970s, an early proponent of running for exercise. His father died at 47, if I remember the story correctly, from a massive heart attack. Of course, his father was grossly overweight. In response to that, Jim Fix said, I'm going to get into shape. And he began to jog and began to run and turned into a very fine physical specimen. Okay, wrote a book, something about running, obviously. Became a huge hit, really started the whole running thing, running shoes, Nike, all this whole kind of stuff. Just started in the 70s because of Jim Fix. They found Jim Fix dead on a roadside at age 52 from a massive heart attack, even though he was in outstanding physical condition. Much of what you see in your patients as dentists and as physicians has a lot to do with their genetics. There's a lot to do, of course, with their own control of their with their own health, but much of it also has to do with their genetics. So the point of that story is not to not exercise, but the point of that story is that, you know, sometimes even when you do all the best things, you end up having trouble. All right, so what happens to all this? Once you get all... Now then, but Dr. Novick, we just went through 4, 5, 6, 7 slides of just getting the fatty acids into the cell. Yes. Why is there such an elaborate mechanism for getting fats into your body and into the cells? There are two reasons why, from my point of view, why it's an elaborate mechanism. I'll tell you what that is. First of all, and it's the most chemical reason, fats and water are not soluble. So you have to have, and you're a water-based creature, so you have to have elaborate mechanisms to get this fat into your body and in a form that's available for the body to use because you're mostly water. Second is, fats are a very valuable source of energy. Valuable source of energy, and so the body is willing to go through all that to capture that much energy, to keep you alive during the down times. Because it's only in recent times has there ever been a situation in humanity where, again, the general population can be considered to be obese. We have that much food and it's that inexpensive and we are moving that little that we can have obese people. First clues of the pathway of fatty acid oxidation. So we're now looking at fatty acid oxidation. How in the world do we know what we're talking about? In Franz Knopp, in 1904, fed dogs labeled fatty acids, that is benzene ring on the end tail. Odd-chain fatty acids produced hippouric acid. Even-chain fatty acids produced phenylacetyluric acid. In other words, they captured the acids in their urine and tested it. He interpreted that as saying the fatty acid oxidation by degradation of two carbon units, which is a very elegant way of doing it. He did not use radioactivity. Radioactivity wasn't even discovered back then. Using radioactivity and labeled isotopes, that was confirmed in the 1950s. So here you have odd-chain fatty acids. If you break them off, you put a benzene ring on the terminal hydrocarbon, you cut it off in two carbon units, you end up with benzoic acid, which is excreted as hippouric acid with that glycine residue on to increase its solubility. Even-chain fatty acids, you end up with a phenylacetic acid, which turns out to be a phenylacetyluric acid. So you either have a 1 or a 2. And so he thought that would... So you never, when he did even-chain fatty acids, he never saw hippouric acid. When he did even-chain fatty acids, he never saw hippouric acid. When he did odd-chain fatty acids, he saw lots of phenylacetic acid, but he also found hippouric acid. A small amount of that. Now, once the fatty acid gets into your cell, and we're not going to discuss how that happens, many times it's just by diffusion, but once a fatty acid is in the cell, it has to be activated. It also has to be protected from changing the pH of your cell. So fatty acids then are what's known as, quote, activated. So you have this fatty acid, you have an ATP coming in. There's an enzyme that acts on that, that creates, whose name is not listed here, creates this acyl-CoA and AMP. So the activated fatty acid has that thioester bond right there, that acyl-CoA group, and so you now have an activated fatty acid. But Dr. Novak, isn't that just like acetyl-CoA? Yes, except it's having two carbons there. There are 16 or 14 or 18 or 12, whatever that is. That's that activated fatty acid. What happens after that? Okay. The enzyme is called acyl-CoA synthetases. So this is a description of what happened in the previous overhead. Now I'm on overhead number 9. The fatty acids become high-energy intermediates. High-energy intermediates. after they've been activated by these acyl-CoA synthetases with particular chain link specificities, occurs in the cytosol. Final compound is called acyl-CoA. The hydrolysis of PPI drives the reaction to completion. Now they're ready to enter mitochondria for beta oxidation. Huh? Oxidation occurs inside the mitochondria. Synthesis occurs in the cytosol. So there's a physical separation of those two pathways. Transported into the mitochondria. So you have these fatty acids. They're attached to CoA. They have to get into the mitochondria, into the matrix of the mitochondria. They simply can't cross. They have to be transported. But oddly enough, they're not transported as acyl-CoAs. They're transported as carnitine derivatives. Acyl-carnitines can be, because enzyme called carnitine palmitoyltransferase 1 and 2 exchanges the CoA for a carnitine. The carnitines then are translocated to the mitochondria by enzymes called carnitine carrier proteins. That within the mitochondria, the acyl-CoA is reformed. The carnitine is transported back. Short-chain acyl-CoAs can diffuse. So looking at this diagram down here, here they have the activated fatty acids. We transfer that fatty acid chain to carnitine. It's transported into the matrix of the mitochondria. The reverse reaction occurs where you've got the acyl-CoA made again. The carnitine is recycled out, and that simply occurs on a continuous ongoing basis. This is just to get that acyl-CoA in the interior. Here's another detail of the enzyme. Carnitine palmitoyl transferase. Here's carnitine. Here's palmitoyl oil. You produce that acyl-carnitine right there, and you produce the free CoA right there, and that's basically number one. Food supplement makers have claimed that carnitine is a fat burner. You can go into a natural food store and buy bottles of carnitine, and they'll claim it's a fat burner. What's the biochemistry basis for claiming it's a fat burner right now? What does carnitine do? What did I just get finished talking about? What does carnitine do? It attaches to the fatty acid and moves it into the mitochondria, where it gets, quote, burned. So, is in fact carnitine a, quote, fat burner? Well, no, it's a fat transport compound, protein. Now, this works. This is only true if you have low levels of carnitine that naturally exist in your body and high levels, and those low levels are inhibiting fat transport. You have no knowledge. You have no clue if that's actually your case or not. You don't know. I don't know of any measurement that would indicate that. Why, then, can they sell this as a fat burner? Well, because some biochemist claims it could be. And notice carnitine is highly polarized. It's highly water-soluble. It's easily absorbed, easily excreted, so you can hardly get an excess of carnitine. It's kind of like ascorbic acid or vitamin C. You can take grams of vitamin C every day and not get an excess because vitamin C is water-soluble, and you excrete it right out your urine. You're going to have very expensive urine. Well, with this carnitine stuff, you're liable to have very expensive urine as well. Okay, so now you now have the fat, the acid, in the mitochondria. And inside the matrix of the mitochondria is the enzyme for beta oxidation of fatty acids. Do you see that right here? Do you recognize this? There's fatty acyl-CoA. Acyl-CoA dehydrogenase. Now then, have I told you, you are now looking at the very end of the semester, my favorite protein, my favorite enzyme. Is right here, that one, acyl-CoA dehydrogenase. The reason being is because what it does, it takes a simple alkane bond and makes it into an alkene bond in a single step at 37 degrees at one atmospheric pressure in a water solution. You can't do that. There's no organic chemistry reaction that will do that for you. And here it is occurring every day, millions and billions of times a day, in your body. Takes those electrons, sends them to the electron transport system where they make ATP. So now you have that double bond. You go from a non-reactive bond to a highly reactive bond, and you're on your way. So the two that double bond gets water added to it by this enol-CoA hydratase, makes an alcohol, a dehydrogenase comes in, makes it a carbonyl group, a coash, and a thiolase comes in, breaks off a two-carbon unit to make acetyl-CoA, and that fatty acyl-CoA is two carbons shorter and starts the whole process all over again. It's a magnificently easy way of making energy out of that fat. And not surprisingly, it's a magnificent way, if you reversed it, to synthesize fatty acids as well, and that's what you find when we get the fatty acid synthesis. Again, it all starts right there at that particular alpha-beta bond to make that double-bonded carbon. Why do you think that occurs right there, ladies and gentlemen? Why do you think it occurs right at, between the alpha and the beta and not the beta and the beta and the gamma? It's what? It's a conjugated with the what? The carbonyl group. Yeah. The influence of the carbonyl group makes that carbon hydrogens particularly susceptible, slightly acidic. And so it gives a lower energy process. It could not occur down here in the beta, gamma, or whatever, succeeding things. It has to happen right here because of the influence of the carbonyl group. Hallelujah, brother. All right. Now, did you memorize this before? Yes. You need to keep this in mind? Yeah. Is there a lot of energy we can get out of this? Notice what you go through here. A dehydrogenation reaction, a hydration reaction, a hydration, a Claisen ester cleavage. This is why you take organic chemistry before you take biochemistry. Basically, you're all going to become applied biochemists. Even the going to graduate school are going to do that. All right, so what happens? One fat molecule composed of three palmitic fatty acids and glycerol. So you have three palmitic acid molecules, the ATP equivalents. The activation is -2. Each round of oxidation gives you +2, +3, +9, +2, +1, +9, +2, +1. And then the tail here, the last round, is this. Let's see here, ATP equivalents. Oh, I see. No, 14, 20. So, basically, there's 129 ATP per fatty acid. There's 387 ATP for fatty acids in one fat molecule. 387 ATP. That's a tremendous energy. How many ATP do you get out of the one glucose molecule? 36. How many do you get out of one fat molecule? Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you tomorrow. We're having a help session when? Tonight at 5:30 here, unless you see a sign otherwise. I'm sorry? The test is Wednesday, is that correct? Oh. We'll stop here for the test. But for tomorrow, you'll have to, it's for the final. Yeah. What? I'm not going to have the reading guides for that. Just for the final. Yeah. Then the metabolic quizzes, I will send you a note indicating what specific metabolic quizzes I'm going to have you on this test. There'll probably be ones that are specifically related to the ACS final.